South African Diary, 25th of January to the 3rd of February 2008. When the Cardinal and I set out from Heathrow on Friday, January 25th, to fly to Cape Town and then on to Durban, I had little doubt that the centrepiece of our visit to South Africa was going to be the 36 hours that we were going to spend in Zimbabwe. But we had 3 days with the South African Bishops' Conference first, and it was that which took us to Durban. They meet in a conference centre which is part of a monastic campus called Marion Hill, about 25 miles outside Durban. They appear to work harder than we do as a conference, in that they have 2 meetings a year, each of which lasts a week. The bishops gave us a very warm welcome, and we were there at the invitation of Cardinal Wilfrid Napier, who is the Archbishop of Durban. Although we shared the accommodation of the campus with them, we didn't actually join their formal meeting until the Monday morning. On the Saturday afternoon, we visited an AIDS hospice in the Valley of the Thousand Hills north of Durban, which is funded by the Pontifical Mission Societies, and there we were able to speak with patients and staff. After Mass on the Sunday morning, we made our way under the auspices of CAFOD to Pietermaritzburg to meet with the Chief Executive of the KwaZulu-Natal Council of Churches. She was able to give us a useful briefing on the work of the consortium of churches which make up the council. Sooner or later, almost every conversation in Southern Africa will come round to the question of HIV/AIDS and the pandemic that it represents in the countries. Estimates differ about the number of people infected, but it is almost never less than 25% of the population. And this figure includes, of course, many children who are orphans, their parents having died of AIDS-related illnesses. HIV/AIDS represents a tragic spectre that haunts the people. It's easily said that no one dies of AIDS, and that can well be true now in the UK. Antiretroviral drugs, ARV for short, are available and at reasonable prices, but their effectiveness depends on early diagnosis, a regular and sustaining diet, and the capacity for a reasonably regular lifestyle. Our visit that afternoon to 3 or 4 homes in one of the townships soon demonstrated to us that those conditions are rarely those which govern the lives of the poor. We visited one home where the head of the household was an old granny, and the family lived off her meagre pension. Food was scarce, the home conditions were very poor, and all the surviving members of the family, about 10 altogether, were HIV/AIDS infected. There was precious little long-term hope, though. And yet, South Africa is a relatively prosperous country. We returned to Durban quite chastened by our experience, but we'd seen at first hand some of the pastoral problems which affect our brother bishops in that country. Incidentally, the Catholic Church in South Africa is one of the most effective sources of the ARV drugs, but it can often seem only like a drop in the ocean. We spent the Monday morning in conference with the bishops, sharing with them how we saw the church in England and Wales, and taking part in their debates and listening and learning from them. An underlying purpose for our visit was that it should be a tangible and heartfelt expression of solidarity and support for a wonderful group of pastors who face very intractable problems in the development of post-apartheid South Africa. On the Tuesday, we flew to Johannesburg, changed planes, and then went on to Zimbabwe and its capital, Harare. Harare's so-called international airport is, I imagine, a little like the Marie Celeste. All the buildings and equipment are there, but except when a plane comes or goes, there's scarcely anybody else around. We were warmly welcomed by some of our hosts, including Archbishop Robert, the Archbishop of Harare, and the President of the Bishops' Conference, and the chargé d'affaires at the Nunciature. And when we paid out our $55 each for our entry visa, we made our way into the city through deserted streets. Our resting place was the Dominican convent in the centre of town, and there we were to spend the next 2 nights. On the Wednesday morning, we had a very full meeting, visiting a diocesan centre for spirituality, which can house 150 people, admittedly in dormitory conditions, and which is busy every weekend with different groups. Some of you may remember that when I was last in Harare some 2 years ago, on the Sunday that I was there, I went to Mass in a township called Umbare. This had been one of the communities that had been devastated by the regime some months earlier, and devastation had meant the bulldozing of all the shanty dwellings and the premises of the street traders who are such a feature of township life in Zimbabwe. People's homes and livelihoods had been ruthlessly destroyed by the police and the military. And why? It's said that this was one of the areas of population which had dared to voice opposition through the ballot box to the re-election of Robert Mugabe. To visit this township some 2 years on was a desperately sobering experience. If things were bad 2 years ago, they're far worse now. We spent an hour listening to a German Jesuit who was the parish priest, hearing how he ministered to his people who were hungry, homeless, and diseased. It was one of the most moving moments of the whole journey, experiencing how faith and love can triumph over almost all adversity and suffering. I, for one, do not know how I could possibly survive as a pastor in such seemingly hopeless conditions. And yet, here was faith, courage, optimism, and hope. When we drove away to our next visit, the cars were silent, and we each had to try to absorb and make sense of all that we'd seen and heard. I mentioned the presence in South Africa of countless orphans. If anything, the situation in Zimbabwe is worse. But as one would expect, the church is at the heart of the care and love of the poor. We went to a hospice run by an Irish sister of the Little Company of Mary, the Blue Nuns, so-called, who were founded by Mary Potter, who came from Southsea. As well as the hospice for children infected with HIV/AIDS that she supervises, she also administers a team of about 70 workers who care for the orphans on the streets and in their so-called homes. It is an extraordinarily beautiful and loving work, which seeks to bring comfort and nursing to the poorest of the poor. And once again, we were left speechless by what we saw and heard. And it was quite hard to go back to a relatively normal lunch. The cathedral in Harare, the Sacred Heart Cathedral, is still run by English Jesuits. And together with Archbishop Robert, we celebrated Mass there in the evening with Cardinal Cormack as the preacher. We were not there to conduct a political campaign against a ruthless regime, but we were there to stand alongside our brothers and sisters who are suffering with such courage and in such poverty, and it was a privilege to be able to do so. Our stay in Zimbabwe was short, but we spent a very instructive hour the next morning with members of the Bishops' Conference who briefed us on the current state of affairs. We were told that the political leaders have no solutions to the problems that the country faces. 24,000% was the inflation rate on the morning we left. ZANU-PF is the ruling party, and there's no effective opposition, though it seems now that Simba Makoni, a former Minister of Finance in the Mugabe government, is to stand against him in the presidential elections, which are due at the end of March. It all seems so hopeless, and yet there are seeds of hope. God Hears the Cry of the Oppressed was the title of a pastoral letter issued by the bishops on Holy Thursday last year, and it was a brave attempt to offer guidance, light, and hope in such difficult times. But such is the complexity of the political scenario that this letter, so bravely written and published, found opposition and division even within the community of the faithful. The letter was an appeal to the people, but it led inevitably to a conflict with the government as well as among the faith communities. There's a desperate need for a new constitution which can incorporate justice with good government and the basic rights of the people, especially the poor, who are the vast majority of the population. The closing words of the pastoral letter are worth quoting in full. We conclude by affirming with a clear and unambiguous yes our support for morally legitimate political authority. At the same time, we say an equally clear and unambiguous no to power through violence, oppression, and intimidation, to say nothing of torture. We call on those responsible for the current crisis in our country to repent and to listen to the cry of their citizens. To the people of Zimbabwe, we appeal for peace and restraint while expressing their justified grievances and demonstrating for their human rights. Such words as these written in that pastoral letter call for concrete action, for symbols and gestures, not just from the suffering people of Zimbabwe, but from all of us who share faith and human kinship with them. Lent is the best of times for us to identify with the struggles and sufferings of our sisters and brothers, and I suggest that we do so in the traditional ways of prayer, fasting and almsgiving for Zimbabwe. We left Zimbabwe in a way devastated by all we'd seen and heard, and yet sustained and encouraged by the bravery, the love, the hope, and the sheer naked faith of all that we'd experienced. 2 days in Cape Town rounded off our visit, and that was wonderful. But I don't think any of us will ever forget those brief 36 hours in Zimbabwe when we heard and listened to the cry of the oppressed.